Do you know the story about the Zen master and the little boy?
Oh, is this some from Nitsa, the Greek witch of Aqualipa, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is. There's a little boy. On his 14th birthday, he gets a horse. And everybody in the village says, "How wonderful, the boy got a horse." And the Zen master says, "We'll see." 2 years later, the boy falls off the horse, breaks his leg, and everybody in the village says, "How terrible." And the Zen master says, "We'll see." Then a war breaks out, and all the young men have to go off and fight, except the boy can't because his leg's all messed up. And everybody in the village says, "How wonderful."
And the Zen master says, "We'll see."
So you get it.
No. No, I know that, because I'm stupid.
You're not stupid. You're just in Congress.
Do you know the Eightfold Fence? From the time we are small, it is something we are taught to build within ourselves. An impenetrable wall behind which we can retreat whenever we need. You must train yourself to listen without hearing. For instance, you can listen to the sound of a blossom falling or the rocks growing. If you really listen, your present circumstance vanishes. Do not be fooled by our politeness, our bows, our maze of rituals. Beneath it all, we could be a great distance away. Safe. And alone.
Happy heresies and welcome to the Desert of the Real. You just heard a duo of clips that highlight that holy Eastern detachment, that transcendental stoicism that all mystics and most women understand so well. The Gnostics in texts like the Sethian Alogenes would call it the sacred inner silence. And to the Valentinians, silence was the great wise mother of the all.
Always remember what the Hindu mystics said. Mind moving fast is crazy. Mind slow is saint. Mind stopped is God.
These clips are relevant because in this eternal now, we will be discussing Welsh mysticism, archonic fairies, and bay portals. Miguel, what does this have to do with Eastern traditions? Has your reason gone silent too? You have burnout, bipolar, Gen X? What else are you gonna say?
Is your idiot brain getting fucked by stupid?
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere.
Glad you asked, rhetorical woke Redditor. A main theme in the show is the forgotten lore and promise of animism, shamanism, and magic, three pillars present in most cultures across the world before Yaldivaldi brought in slave-based civilization, solar religions, linear thinking, and those trains being on time, for better or worse.
Can't just go around doing whatever you feel like. You can't. There are rules in life.
We need to restore these metaphysical orientations before it's too late and the collective psyche of humanity becomes, well, one woke Redditor. One collective Borg-like lagoon of scientism, materialism, and reductionistic thinking. One John Carpenter's The Thing monster with the drooling heads of Neil deGrasse Tyson, Matt Delahunty, Bill Nye, and Sam Harris. One thrust into genocide and trapped forever in the movie Pleasantville without its color scenes.
If you don't take your meat, you can't have any pudding! How can you have any pudding if you don't take your meat?
As G.K. Chesterton said, a madman is not someone who has lost his reason, but someone who has lost everything but his reason. And as Blaise Pascal said, the heart has reasons that reason cannot know. Lastly, as William Blake said, tying the rhetorical woke Redditor to the Archons. I have always found that angels have the vanity to speak of themselves as the only wise. This they do with a confident insolence sprouting from systematic reasoning.
There was an angel that emerged from the cloud. Fire pouring out of its face, its body covered in blood, and its name was Yaldabaoth.
Let's get that animism, shamanism, and magic back. What's more, these three metaphysical orientations tie perfectly into Gnosticism, as I will explain. I mean, Gnosis has been called the knowledge of the heart.
My father says that almost the whole world is asleep. Everybody you know, everybody you see, everybody you talk to. He says that only a few people are awake, and they live in a state of constant, total amazement.
You have come to the very heart of that sacred silence, that Gnosis, the Great Mother, where nothing can harm or touch you. For you are truly yourself here. Where are you?
This is blasphemy! This is madness!
Aeon by Gnostic Radio, an initiation by conversation into the dark corners of myth, magic, and meaning. A crash course in cult, culture, and conspiracy. A virtuous virus invoking and informing history, holiness, and heresy. Each week I, your host Miguel Connor, commandeers your connection to bring you the most accepted and rejected scholars and provocateurs to your attention. Fun, compelling, and deeply weird, this is the blow-your-mind cocktail party conversation you always wanted to listen in on. And you deserve to be here, for you are a shining, crazy diamond that should be seen and can ignite the universe with so much wonder. You are the true sound of silence. 10,000 listeners, maybe more.
Satellite's been up there for thousands of years. What the ancient Hebrews were to Egypt and the early Christians were to Rome, we are now to this corrupt new American empire. It's an ancient fight, Nick. The values of the individual against the supremacy of the state.
Always an honor to host friend, collaborator, and my publisher of The Voices book, Andrew Philip Smith. He will discuss his new work, Pages from a Welsh Cunning Man's Book. Great, unique, important, and timeless work that will get you in that animistic, shamanistic, and magical mood. Maybe even open some fey portals.
No, we're not gonna fucking do Stonehenge!
There is not much else I can say about Andrew, since he has improved Gnostic scholarship and even Western esoterica like few have in the past 15 years, and certainly improved the virtual Alexandria.
Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
Speaking of Gnostic scholarship, thanks to the work of academics like April DeConnick, it's no secret that Gnosticism is shamanistic at its core. Gnosticism is about ecstatic rituals, mind, body, and soul healing, and traveling the spiritual realms for transcendental truths, healing modalities, and forgotten dreams. It's about handling the primordial snake and negotiating the trickster. Plus, scholars like Margaret Barker and James McGrath, as well as researchers like Tobias Churton, Lynn Picknett, and Clive Prince, have revealed that Gnosticism might be the carrier of the contraband mysteries of Ashira and Anat, the holders of the secrets of Solomon, the keepers of the suppressed animistic traditions of the Hebrews of old. The Gnostics kept this magic and then fused it with the Egyptian mysteries, seasoned it with Zoroastrian and Greek esotericism, and voila, classical Gnosticism came about.
However, in the Thomas Gospel, Jesus says, "He who drinks from my mouth will become as I am, and I shall be he." Wow, that's Buddhism. We are all manifestations of Buddha consciousness, only don't know it.
So, Gnosticism is in line with other animistic, shamanistic, and magical traditions, like those found in Wales and Japan of old. The difference is that Gnostic thought jives so well with the modern condition of simulation theory, tyrannical archon control, divine feminine restoration, shadow work, and inner/outer layers of reality.
Birth is a curse and existence is a prison.
Regardless, let's push back, you and I, before it's too late. Let's fight against one collective lagoon of scientism, materialism, and reductionistic thinking. One John Carpenter's The Thing monster with the drooling heads of Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, Matt Dillahunty, and Sam Harris. One thrust to genocide and trapped forever in the movie Pleasantville without the color scenes. Borrowing from Radiohead's Karma Police, they talk in maths with their Hitler hairdos.
You cannot play God, then wash your hands of the things that you've created. Sooner or later, the day comes when you can't hide from the things that you've done anymore.
Let us end with the words of Nietzsche, which perfectly taps into the forgotten ways and warns against this world of runaway reason. From Thus Spake Zarathustra. When I came to men, I found them sitting on an old conceit, the conceit that they have long known what is good and evil for men. All talk of virtue seemed an old and weary matter to men, and whoever wanted to sleep well still talked of good and evil before going to sleep. I disturbed the sleepiness when I taught. What is good and evil, no one knows yet, unless it be He who creates. He, however, creates man's goals and gives the earth its meaning and its future. That anything at all is good and evil, that is His creation. And I bade them overthrow their old academic chairs and whatever that old conceit had sat. I bade them laugh at their great masters of virtue and saints and poets and world redeemers. I bade them laugh at their gloomy sages and at whoever had, at any time, sat on the tree of life like a black scarecrow. I sat down by their great tomb road among cadavers and vultures, and I laughed at all their past and its rotting, decaying glory. My wise longing cried and laughed thus out of me, born in the mountains, verily a wild wisdom, my great broad-winged longing, and often it swept me away and up and afar, in the middle of my laughter, and I flew quivering, an arrow through sun-drunken delight, away to distant futures which no dream had yet seen. Led us to our interview with Andrew Philip Smith.
Hundreds of years before the dawn of history lived a strange race of people. The Druids. No one knows who they were or what they were doing, but their legacy remains hewn into the living rock.
This is the Aeon Bide interview, and with us, it is always a pleasure to be joined by Andrew Philip Smith, this time to discuss his newest book, Pages from a Welsh Cunning Man's Book. Andrew, thank you for coming back again. One of these days you will be the champion of Aeon Byte appearances.
Yes, great to be back, Miguel. So have I slipped down in the ranking recently?
I don't know. That's a good question. It's hard to keep track of these things. We'll have to ask the AI once it takes over the world. That'll be one of my last requests before they pulverize us. But
yeah, you'll be interviewing just AI bots probably in a few years' time. But actually, you won't. It'll be AI bots interviewing AI bots by that point. Yeah.
And with us too, somebody who is not an AI bot, and that is the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Hello, this is Vance's Moondog's AI bot. I'm sorry.
Oh no, they got him. They got him.
I'm sorry. We have assimilated him. Thought that would be funny. And great to see Andrew here again. I always think of him as one of the closest friends to Aeon Byte, having been the publisher of your books and so forth. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about Welsh spirituality and love Welsh myths and so forth. And I got a couple interesting questions up my sleeve too.
Yeah, I have Andrew's books all on my bookshelf.
I was wondering why that photo of you, Vance, had three arms in it.
And 50 fingers, right?
Exactly. Something's off. Well, awesome, Andrew. Well, I guess we should start. Tell us about the book you published, this non-Gnostic book.
Yeah, well, I'd kind of run out of steam a bit with the Gnosticism, having, you know, written a few books about it. And I still do have a couple of subjects I'd like to go back to that I will get round to eventually. So I'm from Wales, and I didn't really live in Wales, or hardly, for 30 years. You know, I didn't leave Wales till I was 21. And then I was like 10 years around London, 10 years in Northern California, and 10 years in Dublin. And then we moved back 6 years ago. And when I moved back, I wanted to write about Welsh stuff, kind of things I was interested in. So the mythology and magic as well. And I've been, you know, pretty interested in magic for a while. And in fact, one of those Gnostic books might be a book about Gnostic magic, if I get round to it. So I was researching about what we know about Welsh magic. And this is sort of the historical magic that we actually know about, because there's some pretty out there stuff, you know, about Welsh magic, and even some pretty weird stuff about Welsh mythology. So I started doing the research, and I was interested in actual magical books and, you know, what survived in manuscripts, that kind of stuff. And there was an interesting book written in the 1970s, written in the Welsh language, called Byd Dyn Hysbys, which means the world of the cunning man. And and it's quite rare and hard to get hold of, and it's never been translated into English. So I was, looking through that, looking for sources. And the author, who was a lady by the name of Kate Bosser Griffiths, she included what she called Llyfr Cyfrin y Dyn Hysbys, or Sir Ddinbych, the secret book of the cunning man of Denbighshire. Denbighshire is a county in the northeast of Wales, and I'm down in the southeast here. And so she was discussing various aspects of kind of folk magic, basically, in Wales. And she would occasionally quote from this notebook that she'd had access to. And she didn't quote from it very systematically. It was just, you know, if she was writing about fairy magic, she'd include these bits in the notebook. And if she's writing about geomancy, which was a kind of divination practice, she'd include some bits about geomancy from the notebook as well. And she would include the pages that she found them in the notebook. So I went through the entire book, and I extracted all of the references to the from the notebook, and I put them in order to see what I could find out about it. And I thought, oh, this is pretty interesting, probably worth publishing. And in the meantime, I'd found a 19th century printed book which was quite substantial, and I started translating that into English. And so I was working on that, and then I thought, oh, well, actually, the Clifford Coven, this secret book, that could be like an appendix to the book about what I'm calling a Welsh Book of Knowledge. So I thought, okay, let's work on the appendix first. And then it just really expanded. It became fascinating. First of all, trying to work out where this material was coming from. And then also there's a little journal entry, which was actually written in English, not somewhat imperfect English. The author, cunning man, he describes how he met up with a farmer in Wrexham, and the farmer's cattle weren't doing very well. They weren't giving much milk, and when they did give the milk, it wasn't churning properly into butter. And this farmer had already called upon the services of another cunning man, who he called Sean Rosses. And he'd used him a couple of times and paid him, but to no success. And then Sean Rosses said, oh, he couldn't help him for a while because the moon faces need to be right, you know, as good an excuse as I've heard from anybody.
I use it all the time for when I'm late, you know.
Yes, yeah, the moon phases. So he said, okay, so he went and did his business at the cunning man's, at the farmer's farm. And afterwards, the cows were giving great milk and the butter was finer than it had ever been. So it's an intriguing little glimpse into the life of one of these cunning men. And I was doing loads of research, and we're quite well served in Wales by the National Library. So they have a really good website, and they've digitized all these journals from the 19th century.
Wow.
And so there was quite a thriving publishing industry in Wales in the 19th century, you know, a lot of it in the Welsh language. And so I was able to search through these, and you can, you know, get all sorts of background, you know, and there was a kind of antiquarian interest going on as well, because Wales was a very Protestant country, and a lot of these magical practices were sort of associated with Catholicism. Just a little bit of background, all these Protestant churches, they're what we call chapel in Wales rather than church, but there were just dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of them, you know, and every village had its own, like three chapels. It was a real sort of religious mania going on, and they could often be very disapproving of the existing Welsh culture, you know, the kind of songs and the even from dancing to the harp, you know, what could be a more innocent activity than that?
But, yeah.
That became forbidden, you know.
Oh, wow.
But later in the century, it went into decline, all these magical practices, although it did persist, you know, well into the middle of the 20th century. But later in the 19th century, people actually started to get interested in their native traditions and their local traditions. And partly, you know, we had the Protestantism, but also with secularism. So they started to see them, you know, not necessarily as a threat as they had previously, but okay, we don't really do it anymore. I mean, there's some of the older folk do and some of the country folk do, but it's actually interesting. So in these sort of folklore journals and all sorts of periodicals, people start writing their accounts of what was their memories and everything. And another interesting source is court records. So some of the people who practiced this stuff were fraudsters. And, maybe I ought to go into the, you know, what a cunning man is.
Yeah. You know? That was actually, my next question. But first, interesting about the chapels, because I know the one chapel that no Protestant or Catholic would dare touch, and that's the St. Elvis Chapel, right? You sent me the information, and it was fascinating. So
Yeah, yeah, with your Elvis Presley book and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so there's a chapel to Saint Elvis. I think there's a Saint Elvis's Bay as well.
Yeah, I think the information there. Yeah, there's a well, and this is dedicated to Aelfi, also known as Aelbi. Right, he's a saint there.
Yeah, well, in Wales we have all these saints because it's you know what some people call the Celtic Church. Mm-hmm. And there was a period, particularly like in the 6th century, where, you know, because Britain became Christian relatively early on because it was part of the Roman Empire.
Right.
But sort of native traditions were still sort of persisting alongside it. And then when the Romans left in, I think, the sort of 4th century, things started to fall apart. But then by the time of the 6th century, you had all these little saints wandering around. You know, so the patron saint of Wales is Dewi Sant, Saint David. And so there are all these saints' lives with really weird stuff going on in them. So that it's, the saints kind of appropriated the native traditions. They have all this otherworldly stuff going on, and they're doing all these miracles and all that kind of stuff, but there are just loads and loads of saints, and lots of places are named after these saints, you know, and they're not saints in the Catholic Church, most of them. I think Saint David is, where I live, it's called Caddoxton, which, you know, which is a sort of English name, but Tregatog is the Welsh name, but that's Saint Cadoc, and so there's like Llanilltid, that's Saint Illtid, and there's just loads of them. And, you know, anywhere you go in Wales, the these local places are named after saints. And, how did I get onto that? Saint Elvis, wasn't it? Yeah.
What time frame were we talking about when the Catholic conversion, you know, came in and the influence happened?
Like St. Elvis was around in the 5th century. He baptized St. David.
Wow.
So it was already, it was pretty early. As soon as, right, isn't that true, Andrew? As soon as Rome turned Christian, England was already being Christianized.
Yeah. Well, England wasn't England yet.
Right, or that area, sorry.
You know, the sort of Angles and Saxons hadn't come over. Even before, you know, in sort of, you know, 3rd, 4th century, I think the sort of Christian remnants and everything. I remember St. Alban, that St. Alban's is a place in England. He was traditionally the sort of first, saint in that part. There were close connections with Ireland, you know, not always harmonious, but Ireland is just over the sea. So, and it went both ways, you know. Saint Patrick was a Briton, so he spoke basically a precursor of Welsh, you know, the Brythonic language developed after the Romans left. It changed considerably, it became Welsh and then Cornish down in the southwest of England, and Breton in the west of France. That's also a language that's related to Welsh, like a sister language. So you had all this to-ing and fro-ing. So there was Saint Patrick. He was kind of kidnapped by pirates, and he was over in Ireland, and he was actually brought up as a Christian. But then I think he made his way back to Britain, and then decided he ought to go and convert Ireland. You know, they have all that story. But then the church in Ireland became quite distinctive, and, you know, with the collapse of the Roman Empire, Ireland was actually in quite a strong position. So the Ireland was sending all these missionaries out, you know, to all parts of Europe, and it had this tradition of scholarship in the monasteries, and Wales did too. So I think Elvis, he was Irish, not Elvis Presley. I mean, Elvis Presley might have been. I remember seeing that I think Elvis Presley's mother was called Gladys.
Right. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a Welsh name.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's hard to get Elvis's lineage, Presley's lineage. So.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah.
But I'm sure St. Elvis was singing Suspicious Minds while he was converting people.
Yeah, well, we actually have a Elvis Presley imitator festival, impersonator festival.
That's great.
Annually in a place called Porthcawl, which isn't too far away. And I was actually at dinner with the guy who started
really?
The festival. You know, it's a really big thing. You know, this little Welsh seaside town is packed with Elvis Presley impersonators once a year. You
know? Oh, this world is great. Yeah, the syncretism is awesome. Humanity and its ideas of syncretism. So, well, awesome. Well, let's get to what a cunning man is in Welsh tradition.
Yeah, so this isn't just in Welsh tradition. You had them in England as well. And may even have passed over into Wales from England, you know, somewhat replacing other magical practitioners. But a cunning man was, you know, sort of your local magical practitioner. And, you know, the word cunning in this sense means kind of wise, you know, knowing. And there are various Welsh terms, dyn hysbys, so that has sort of the connotation of an expert, you know, or gŵr cyfarwydd is another term that was more common in North Wales. So these were your local guys who would do magic for you, and they would do all sorts of things from fortune telling to cattle healing, to, you know, a certain amount of herbalism and finding lost objects or working out who'd stolen your piece of cloth, that kind of stuff. And they were very much embedded in the community. And in Wales in particular, they weren't, you know, kind of rapacious, money-grabbing for the most guys, for the most part. That they would take payments, but they would allow the people to decide, you know, how much you'd pay. And the I think the modern academic term for them is a service magician. You know, and I was thinking actually, you know, in America you do have still a kind of a living tradition in the hoodoo tradition,
right? Yeah,
in, you know, like in the South. Which I think hoodoo is actually Protestant, isn't it? Voodoo is kind of linked to Catholicism, but hoodoo is a sort of Protestant tradition. And then, so you still get people who do the similar kind of things. Root doctors is a term I remember. So, you know, and you have to, Wales was pretty rural then. You know, the Industrial Revolution was huge in Wales in the 19th century. And we were actually kind of at the forefront of, you know, lots of developments. I think the kind of the first trains ran in Wales for an ironworks. You know, so we were developing iron, and then we had in the south, in parts of the north, we had the coal mining. So we were providing coal for the, you know, the whole of the British Empire. You know, my grandfather was briefly a coal miner, and many generations before that were coal miners. But Wales was pretty rural and kind of backwards in comparison to England, you know, which was a sort of powerhouse of modernization and everything. So you had the Dyn Hysbys. And that there are loads of surviving traditions about them in Wales. I think much more proportionally than in England, often in folklore. So all these tales where basically something goes wrong and the Dyn Hysbys has to be called in to help people out. And they were literate as well. They were kind of, they weren't only sort of traditional folk magic practitioners, they were also interested in sort of the cutting edge of magic. So they would collect books, and also the, another advantage of having the books is that you would impress the local population. You know, we had a big black leather bound book, you know, and you'd pull that out when your client was coming in to talk with you. You know.
Yeah, in those days, it was like having a Tesla. It was very expensive.
So that was the cunning man, and we have lots of traditions and a certain amount of texts connected with them.
So the cunning man was somebody, he was embedded with the village or the tribe, and he wasn't just wandering. Could we say they were akin to a shaman? If some have said, Andrew, a shaman is the village's spiritual troubleshooter. Would that be close to accurate?
Somewhat, yeah. I think it's kind of quite fair. It's not as you know, I don't think they had the kind of initiations that you get in shamanism, something along those lines. You would go to the cunning man when something, you know, something was going wrong in connection with the sort of spirit world. That's quite interesting because, you know, remember, we're very much in a Christian society. So there's only a certain space for spirits in Christianity. So they could be demons. And you don't see that so much in Wales, of course, but you do see, you know, in the sort of the magical grimoires, they have lots of stuff about summoning and controlling demons. But in Wales, it's particularly fairies that they would work with. And in this notebook, there's a spell about summoning fairies, these seven sisters, who were kind of pan-European fairies. But the fairies in Wales are called the Tylwyth Teg, like the fair, well, tribe, but it would be a literal translation. And Wales actually has some of the sort of earliest surviving fairy-like tales going back to about the 12th century. Fairies, you know, if you think of a fairy, you think of Tinkerbell, you know, it's a pretty girl, she's got a pair of wings on her back, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But these were more, you know, they're often seen as kind of pygmies, as small people. They would live in an otherworldly realm, which people would sometimes be able to visit. They would sort of appear out of nowhere, and they were kind of dangerous to interact with, you know. So you wanted to sort of propitiate them, you know, to be nice to them. There's several folk tales, you know, it might be harvest, everybody's bringing in the harvest, and then one guy sees the fairies dancing in a circle, and they sort of grab him, and he's dancing in the circle with them, and then he disappears. And so, you know, and there's usually like a companion with him who sees this. And then, he's gone. So they go to the Dean Huspis, the cunning man, and, he gives them instructions. He says, okay, you've got to be there in a year and a day, go back to the same spot in a year and a day, and you'll see your friend dancing with the fairies again. And so when you do that, grab him, pull him out of the circle, and you'll get him back, you know.
It's like a portal.
Yeah. Well, some of the portals were lakes, caves, you know, that kind of thing. Those were entrances to the other world. And I think particularly in Wales, the fairy traditions were very linked with older traditions about an other world, which, you know, it's not heaven. It's very much linked with this world, but it sort of operates in parallel with this world. And there's often a society going on that's somewhat similar to our society, but has these strange differences. The people might seem to be, you know, almost immortal, or they might be under strange sort of conditions that mortals have to help them with. So there's a set of Welsh myths from the medieval period known as the Mabinogion, and the sort of the most notable stories in there are called the Four Branches of the Mabinogi. And in each of those, there are these strange otherworldly stuff going on. And in the first one, there's a prince called Pwyll who's out hunting, and he sees a white deer with red ears that's been attacked by somebody's hounds. He drives the hounds off, and he takes the deer for himself, which is a big insult, you know, to whoever's hounds they were. And then he sees the king who had the hounds, and he says, you know, you've done me a grave insult. And this guy is called Arawn. And he says, so Pwyll says, I'll make it up to you. And he says, okay, so what you have to do, I'll make you look like me. You need to spend a year in Annwn, the other world. And he says, and there's a king there that I'm at war with. So after you've been there for a year, you need to battle the king. And when you give him strike the blow that's going to kill him, he's going to beg you to give him another blow, and you mustn't give him that second blow, no matter how much he begs you to finish him off, because the implication is that he'll come back to life if he has that second blow. So he does that, and he feasts every night with Arawn's wife by his side, and he sleeps in the bed with Arawn's wife, but he never makes love to her. You know, and he battles the king called Hafgan at the end of it, and he goes back. And Arawn has been in Pwyll's place in Dyfed, in the kingdom of Dyfed, and Arawn has been, you know, ruling the kingdom really well. And Arawn's very impressed that Pwyll didn't sleep with his wife. And I think the implication there is that if he had slept with his wife, Pwyll would be stuck in Annwn, in the other world, there's, you know, it's like with the if you're in the fairy land, you mustn't eat the food, because
mm-hmm.
They'll invite you to eat the food, but if you eat the food, you're stuck there forever, you know. So there are all these cordial relations between Pwyll and Annwn from then on, and then he Pwyll actually gets a bride who comes from the other world called Rhiannon, very famous name from the Fleetwood Mac song. Oh, yeah. But that's where the name comes from.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So these otherworldly traditions, they kind of morphed into the fairy otherworld in Wales. And you can see all these similarities. One of the most famous fairy stories is about the woman of Llyn y Fan Fach, which is a lake. And this farmer sees a woman coming out of the lake, and he takes her back. You know, she's beautiful, and to be his bride. And he says, okay, I'll be your bride, as long as you don't strike me three times. You know, if you strike me three times, I've got to go back to my people beneath the lake. And of course, So they have children together, and his farm is prospering because of her presence there. And of course, he does strike her three times. But it's funny, in these very sort of strange ways. Like he puts his hand on her shoulder at one point, and that counts as one of the strikes, you know. And eventually, of course, she has to go back, but the children remain. And they actually become this family of physicians who are known as Meddygon Meddfai, the physicians of Meddfai, who are associated with all these medical practices, you know, sort of folk medicine. So that's probably the most famous of these Welsh fairy stories.
They are fascinating, yeah. And Yeah, I want to get back to that. But Vance, do you have a question? I know you mentioned at the beginning you already had questions.
Oh, I've got a pile of them here. A couple of short ones. First of all, you know, I always thought fairies were like Tinkerbell until I saw a Lord of the Rings. Do you think the Lord of the Rings depiction is closer to what the, you know, fairies of Welsh myths portray?
You mean like the elves?
Yeah.
Yes, they are. I know, you know, Tolkien, he learned Welsh. Because, you know, he was a linguist. And he was from Birmingham, you know, in the English Midlands. And he described that seeing, you know, like a coal truck delivering coal, which had words in Welsh on the side, and as a child, and he was fascinated by it, you know. And he based one form of the Welsh of the Elvish language on Welsh. You can see it in aspects of the grammar, you know.
How come there's so many Ys in Welsh words?
Well, Y is a vowel in Welsh. You know, the thing that people who don't know Welsh say is there's no vowels in it. but Y and W are vowels in Welsh.
W too. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, people see it. You know, it's actually simple. It's just an oo sound, the W. But when people see the W in a place where they wouldn't expect it to be in an English word, they're really foxed by it, you know, and they sort of garble it, make a kind of tongue twister out of it. But it's just ooh.
That's me.
So, and also the double L is a very notable sound, you know, like there's a tower, Llanelli, and it's this sort of aspirated L. It's a and you know the cha as well, you know. So there's a town which has both of them in, it's called Machanlleth. If you want to repeat that back to me, Machanlleth.
Machanlleth. Yeah. Not very
good. Bless you.
You know, another thing I was going to ask you about is there are stories that the Egyptians actually migrated to both Scotland and Wales in ancient times. Is there any tie-in with Egyptian lore in Welsh history?
Well, I actually have a book that argues that the Britons were linked to the Egyptians. I haven't read it yet. I have to say, it sounds a bit dodgy for me, but I know, you know, because I know some Coptic, which was the final form of the Egyptian language, and the Welsh and Coptic actually do share this odd grammatical feature that they have what's called conjugated prepositions. Then, you know, the forms of them aren't the same, but grammatically it's a similar kind of thing. So what that means is if you say, you know, in English, you just say on me, on it, on him, you know, on us, that kind of thing. But in Welsh, and in a certain way in Coptic, you actually change the endings for each form that it goes through. So that's a kind of odd connection. And there are, you know, Western European monasticism is thought to have used Egyptian monasticism as a model. So you do get these kind of odd connections. And I remember in Ireland, there was this Psalter, you know, Book of Psalms from, I think, the 8th century that was found in a peat bog a few years ago. And it's on display at the National Museum in Dublin. And that actually, the covers of the book look very similar to the covers of the Nag Hammadi library.
Oh.
And there was Egyptian papyrus used in the packing of the cover of the binding. So how did that got there? Who knows?
Wow. Is Welsh considered separate from the family of Indo-European languages, you know, like Etruscan was? You know, like it's kind of a mysterious origin?
No, it is Indo-European. It's part of the Celtic branch.
Ah, okay.
So so the immediate sister languages are Cornish, which kind of died out. So you know, so Cornwall's in the southwest of England, sort of peninsula, right at the bottom. So kind of quite isolated. And that kind of died out at the end of the 18th century, but it got revived in the 20th century. And now, so there are about, well, I don't know, maybe 500 people or something who speak Cornish as a first language now. That and I think they kind of had to reconstruct it, you know, looking at Welsh as an example, to some extent. But now there are native Cornish speakers, and there's a Welsh musician called Gwenor, who she grew up in Cardiff, trilingually speaking English, Welsh, and Cornish, and she released an album in Cornish. It's like a kind of psychedelic album, which is pretty good. And then in Brittany as well, in the west of France, they have sister language Breton, and Welsh speakers and Breton speakers can understand about half of what each other say, you know. And the Bretons are there, you know. Gaul itself was Celtic speaking, but Breton actually comes from Britain. There were, after, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire and everything, settlers from Britain, from Cornwall and Wales, went over to Brittany and sort of colonized it. And we in Wales, we used to get these onion sellers, Breton onion sellers, who'd go from door to door. You know, they're called Johnny Onions. I remember our next door neighbor who spoke Welsh. She managed to understand a bit of what a Breton was saying. She was in tears, you know, from having that connection. And then the kind of the cousin languages are the Irish, you know, which most people know as Gaelic. But you know, in Ireland they just call it Irish. The Manx language, which also died out pretty recently, although there've been attempts to revive it, and that's the Isle of Man in between England and Ireland, and Scots Gaelic in the sort of Western Isles of Scotland, which is still a living language, you know. But you know, in a bit of trouble as the you know, as all of these minority languages are, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Keep it going as a community language.
Very interesting.
It is. It is fascinating. Now, I wanted to get maybe our comparative mythology, get our Joseph Campbell or Claude Levi Strauss hats on, Andrew. Going back to the fairies, because then I'm thinking, what can we compare to the fairies to? Of course, at first I'm thinking, could they be the archons? Obviously, Jacques Vallée has written a lot of fairy abduction being alien abduction. Of course, we go to the Jungian trickster archetype that seems to be prevalent everywhere. And of course, the spirits are always naughty in very Siberian shamanistic traditions and so forth. What do you think of the fairies? Is there a connection to or a parallel to other traditions, maybe that I've mentioned or something else? Obviously, the illusionary world, the parallel universes, so forth.
Well, yeah, I think it's quite a widespread thing. There was an interesting book that came out last year called The Twilight of the Godlings. I'm trying to think, Francis Young, I think, was the author. But he was arguing that... Well, you know, this isn't a new argument, but that fairies are kind of what the gods became in a Christian society, or one of the things that gods became, you know. And but he uses the term godlings, you know, or small gods. That this, you know, this wasn't Zeus and Poseidon and Athena and all those kinds of gods. These were the little gods, you know, sort of the local gods or the god of some, you know, small function. So I think, yeah, there's definitely a link there, and I think it's partly, you know, because Christianity squeezes out all the other gods, but we do need, you know, people need more than just the big god, you know, who's divorced from what's going on in the world. So I think they, you know, they fulfill that kind of function. You know, for various, as I was saying, you know, they're kind of tricksters. Right. You don't necessarily want them in your life. But there are these traditions of fairy magic. You know, magicians could use them, like for treasure hunting was one, or you know, there was this practice to summon a fairy woman to have sex with, which is a pretty disreputable.
Yeah, yes. No consent.
Yeah. So, you know, but there are all sorts of kind of similar traditions around Europe. And I mean, you know, I'm sure in other places.
Yeah, I mean, even Andrew, yeah, doing the research on the Elvis book, of course, I got into blues, the source of blues. And it's interesting how in blues and in Southern black folklore, Satan takes on the aspects of the trickster or the fairy. Same thing. He wants to make a deal. Sometimes he'll help you. Sometimes he just wants to steal something from you. So you better be careful. You know, it's a different type of devil. And in Europe, Satan kind of takes this sort of fairy aspect that, you know, steals your cattle and gives you a bad deal. You won't go to hell, but it will ruin your life. That kind of stuff.
Cattle mutilations, Miguel.
Yeah, there's an alien thing again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, going back to that kind of stuff, there's Patrick Harper. You might have seen, I interviewed him for The Gnostic, he wrote a really good book in the 90s called Daimonic Reality, where he, and he begins it by quoting this account of, you know, meeting somebody who he's, you know, he has this sort of shiny hat on, his shiny metal clothes. And, you know, and it's a, you know, you think, oh, this is an, you know, alien kind of abduction kind of encounter. And then he shows it was actually a sort of a 16th century account of meeting a fairy. And yeah, I think Jacques Vallée did, you know, a similar thing, you know,
right. Yeah.
Arguing, you know, that these are these sort of otherworldly encounters, you know, including Bigfoot and that kind of stuff, that these are the modern equivalent of fairy encounters, you know, but with our sort of secular civilization now, we don't, you know, if you saw Bigfoot, people might think, you know, what was he smoking? But you might think,
yeah, or Elvis.
It can be taken
people
seriously.
See still way, Elvis.
You know. Yeah, right. But, you know, there is space for, okay, you know, if you had a Bigfoot encounter, there's a certain space for that, you know. Whereas you say I saw a fairy, then you know, you're pretty out of it. You're even more out of it, you know. Or so if you see Bigfoot or an alien, that kind of fits in to the culture, you know, 20th century, 21st century culture. And I think Patrick Harper, he had one account of somebody seeing a Bigfoot, and the person went and put a saucer of milk and some cakes out for it, which is exactly what you should do for the fairies. You know,
really?
If you've had some bad luck with the fairies, I do it occasionally. Yeah. You know, just put a saucer of milk out.
I don't blame you. Don't blame you.
We do that for Santa Claus too, right?
Yeah. We used to leave mince pies downstairs for Santa Claus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he has a similar position. You know, well, of course, he was a saint. You know, saints also, they took up part of the slack of...
The
godlings.
Are there any giants in Welsh mythology that correspond to Bigfoot?
Not correspond to Bigfoot, but there are loads and loads of giant stories, usually connected with landscape features, that kind of stuff. Yeah, I want to go back to the Lord of the Rings thing.
Sure.
Because what was the name of the was it Amazon or Netflix that?
Yeah, The Rings of Power.
The Rings of Power. Yeah.
That was dreadful.
So, but what I did like about it was Galadriel. I thought she was very good. She was very otherworldly. And as it happens, she is a Welsh actress from my hometown.
Yeah. Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. There was a very weird film that she was on in before that, Saint Maud, I think it was called.
Oh yeah, that wasn't bad at all.
Yeah.
That was a decent film.
I thought she was really good, you know.
Yeah,
she,
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, where were we?
Well, what about in Welsh tradition, does Satan kind of supplant the fairies, like in medieval times, like in Portugal and other places and the South? Or does he stay like just an evil guy, the font of evil?
There's not too much about Satan. But, you know, there are traditions about the devils. There are these, there's a bridge called Devil's Bridge near Aberystwyth. It's beautiful. You know, there's like three different small bridges being built over the centuries, one over the other. You know, it's a real tourist spot, beautiful place. And I think there was some story about the devil and a dog to do with establishing the bridge. So there are various devil stories, but he's the folk devil.
Right.
You know, that you were talking about earlier. And actually, I think the story you were alluding to, that was Robert Johnson, wasn't it? The blues thing. He met the devil at the crossroads. And
yeah, last fall I went down there to Mississippi and I visited the place. So, that's the most famous story of the devil and the blues. And interesting, he died the same day as Elvis. There's a lot of weird parallels between Robert Johnson and Elvis that I'm looking into. So, but this was the South. This was the South. The forgotten South, if you would, the Gothic South.
Yeah, I like that, the Gothic South. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, check it out. I enjoyed the book. It's got a lot. We didn't even talk about things like the necromancy spell and the seven sisters. There's just so much wonderful wealth of information there that I enjoyed. And you said you've got another book coming out this year.
Yeah, this is part of a kind of a bigger project. Like I said, this book was meant to just be an appendix. So you can look out for A Welsh Book of Knowledge. And then also Welsh Magic Through the Ages, a selection of spells from all periods of Welsh history, from the very first surviving spell in Wales, which incidentally, that when we were talking about connections with Gnosticism, the oldest spell surviving in Wales is in Greek, written on a piece of gold leaf found in the town of Carnarvon. Which was established as a kind of a Roman town. And that's in the same kind of tradition as the Greek magical papyri, which have links to, the sort of contemporaneous Gnostic stuff. So Welsh Magic Through the Ages. And then I have this long-term project about a dictionary of Welsh mythology and also these sort of Welsh myths and legends. There's a lot of stuff outside of the Mabinogion, some of which has never been translated into English, and some of which has never, but all of it, it's never been collected together. And it makes a lot more sense when you collect it together, and you can see this is all part of a much bigger tradition. So that's an ongoing project as well. And of course, I have all the half completed books that one day I'll get around to. Lives of the Ancient Gnostics, that kind of thing. I just got to crank them out, keep going, finish things, get them out.
We hope you do. Well, awesome. Well, first of all, Vance, thanks for keeping us company.
Oh, it's been fascinating. I love these myths and so forth of, you know, the earlier times. And Andrew, it's been a pleasure and an honor.
Agreed. Yes, great to see you again, Vance.
Yes, Andrew, it's always great to chat with you. We look forward to your future work. And thanks for being here. And thanks for sharing your gnosis.
Diolch yn fawr iawn, as we say in Wales.
What does that mean? Goodbye.
Thanks very much.
Ah, okay. Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And there you have it, yes, shining crazy diamonds. Andrew giving the lore to score those higher realms.
In our second part, we'll explore Celtic cosmology, the afterlife, and some of its myths. Andrew will discuss geomancy and some Welsh divination practices. We'll connect Simon Magus to the Druids and detail how Christianity suppressed so much wonder in the British Isles. And much more. So please become a member for the full Magically Delicious and Delicious Magic. It's only $6.99 for AB Prime a month, or $4.99 at Red Circle, or whatever you want to pledge on Patreon. You'll get access to my private Facebook group and Discord channel for AB Prime members and higher level Patreons. If you find any value in this content, please help grow this Red Pill Cafeteria. Your help can be in the form of a one-time donation on Stripe or the US Mail or crypto. There is also a link on the show notes if you want to leave a tip, or you can tip on any YouTube show or Rockfin show. There's always the merch store and an Amazon wish list. And don't forget the new Gnostic Tarot that is selling very well and people are getting very good spiritual results. And consider the Finding Hermes program, where we have monthly exclusive meetings and presentations, with many past guests hanging out there for some high-octane nooses. If you need any help with any of these choices, just message my ass. I'm always here to help, and I truly appreciate your help. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.